Good afternoon, good day, good evening. Thank you for joining our podcast. I'm Jill Faraday Lloyd, a partner at the Chance Mantione Group. And I'm joined today by Carrie Shuffman, who is the head of UBS's women's segment. I'm delighted to have some incredible new research that's come out of her office about the issues surrounding breadwinning women. So I'd love to just dive in, Carrie, because it's always so much fun to have you on the call. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jill. It's great to be with you for another episode of the podcast.
Carrie, my whole focus is on working with women clients. And the mission that I've stated is that I'm on a mission to inspire women to have agency with their capital in all its forms because of this remarkable wealth transfer which is occurring. And that's due to women's own wealth generation and a double inheritance windfall from both spouses and parents. So much so that by the year 2030, it's anticipated that women will own nearly two-thirds of our nation's wealth. Today, we're focusing on the wealth generation side. But we've seen women continue to make great strides in education and the labor force participation and career advancement. They're contributing more than ever to their family's income. So this research is really fascinating to me. But before we dive in, you've been on the show before, but can you remind us what it is that you do as the head of the women's segment at UBS and what your team does?
Sure, absolutely. And I love your focus and your mission statement, Jill. And you know that we love working with you and your team and really partnering to support women on their financial journeys. And that's really actually what my team and I do. So the women's segment at UBS, we are focused on the development and the implementation of our strategy as a firm at UBS to address the unique financial needs that women have throughout the course of their lifetimes. Our goal is to help women navigate their financial lives and prepare for their financial futures. And we do that through the extensive research, Jill, that you just mentioned, developing educational resources and materials, events, programming, podcasts just like this one today, all on various topics related to women's financial well-being. And I would say, similar to your mission, Jill, our mission as an organization is really threefold. It's to help bring more women to the financial table, to support women who are already at the financial table, and to make that table a more inclusive place for women.
Fantastic. I couldn't agree more with what you're trying to accomplish, and it's very supportive of my journey. Could you tell us a little bit more about the background for this new research and what it is that you were trying to achieve when you set out to do it?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So for the last 6 years, as you know, and I know I've joined the podcast before to talk about prior reports that we've published, but for the last 6 years, we've worked tirelessly to gain a deeper understanding of how women engage in their finances so that we can then be best positioned to better serve women and accomplish what we set out to do, our mission that I just mentioned before. And so each year since 2018, we published an annual report focused on women and financial well-being that we call Own Your Worth, on how women engage in the major financial decisions that shape their lives and their legacies, while also, of course, approaching this research with the foundational belief that women are a population, right? Not a segment, not a niche industry by any means. So each report, we try to look at a specific demographic of women or specific trends that are impacting women at any moment in time to really try to get to the root of this topic of financial well-being for women. And so for our latest report, our latest Own Your Worth report that we just published this summer, titled Tradition, Trust, and Time, we decided to take a closer look at the experience that women's primary breadwinners have when it comes to the money that they're earning and the wealth that they're creating for themselves and their families. And as you mentioned, Jill, women continue to make great strides in education, labor force participation, career advancement, and we know that they're contributing more to their families' incomes than ever before in history. And so we really wanted to understand whether this increasing financial clout translates to increased financial participation in terms of involvement and decisions around what to do with the money that they're earning, particularly with a lens on women who are the primary earners, primary breadwinners. We interchangeably say primary earner or breadwinner. And what challenges women primary breadwinners face when it comes to financial engagement. And so that's actually what we did with this report. We surveyed over 800 women and men in heterosexual couples and women in same-sex couples to try to answer this hypothesis and build out the research. And ultimately what we found that became the catalyst for the broader report is that women who are the primary breadwinners in their households are much less engaged in making decisions, both short-term and long-term financial decisions about where their earnings are going than men breadwinners are. And that's because of a number of challenges that we ultimately uncovered as we continued to build out this research based on that initial finding.
Okay. I want to take this in so many different directions because the research last year that you published on the back of COVID was that women felt more engaged with their finances and wanted to have purpose with their wealth. So I'm going to ask you to talk to that to some degree, but let's dig in on what you saw, right? If women are less engaged in the financial decision-making than their male counterparts, why is that? What did you learn?
So I think that was really the question, right? Why? Particularly if money is power, if money affords us the opportunity to achieve our goals, allay our concerns, live out our life's vision, why is it that more women breadwinners aren't exercising that power through being engaged in the financial decisions? And so from the research, a picture emerged of why many women breadwinners were still relinquishing some of that power over financial decision-making. And I will caveat that while some of those challenges were less pronounced for women in same-sex couples, we found three key reasons for the disparity between women and men breadwinners, which are really actually the title of the report aptly states. It comes down to tradition, trust, and time. So tradition, we heard that many women breadwinners had mixed feelings about being the breadwinner, given societal expectations, gender stereotypes. So for example, less than half of women who were the breadwinners in their families said that they prefer being in this position compared to almost 90% of men breadwinners who said that they prefer being in that breadwinner role. Many women breadwinners said friends and family assume that their male partners are the primary earners and that many don't correct these assumptions within their, you know, inner circles. So that's really that tradition challenge that we found. The second was trust. So many breadwinners said that they face insecurities and trust issues from their non-primary earning partners. So for example, the majority of men who were not the primary earner in their household said that they themselves would prefer to be the breadwinner and that they wish they could contribute more. And many even cited that this difference in earnings has caused tension in their relationship. And we
was that surprising to you all when you read that? I'm going off piste with you right now.
You know, look, I think that there are a lot of sensitivities that we all have around money. Money is deeply personal to each and every one of us and how we grow up, our personal money stories, mm-hmm. how we saw our parents think about and handle money. So, you know, I think that some of that leads to more ingrained gender role expectations. Some of that leads to a feeling of wanting to contribute and take care of your family financially. And all of this gets wrapped up in the personal, the marital, the individual, the family history. So it was maybe surprising to the extent here in 2023 as we see the tremendous advances that women are making, because I do think that this is something that should be celebrated and supported, but at the same time, maybe not as surprising at the end of the day, just given all of those sensitivities around financial related topics that we all have, whether we're married, single, 25, 85, you know, wherever we are in our lives.
Some of the stats I found really interesting, if we can drill down in this trust area, is around the men non-primary earners being more concerned about how much money their wife or spouse spends and the fact that they want to try to hold her back from spending that. It's interesting, right? It's a bit of, I don't have control over the earnings, but I feel uncomfortable around it, so I need to control something, perhaps.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's elements of wanting to control decisions within your household. I think that's honestly ties back to the broader own your worth message, right? We want everybody to have a say in the financial decisions that impact them and their lives, but certainly if there are perceived unequal dynamics when it comes to money and power and earning, people may try to compensate in other ways. You know, maybe you may not be earning the money, but if you feel really strongly about how it should be spent, you may sort of focus on that. I do think, again, it comes back to these sensitivities around money, expectations, the division of labor, who's doing what, who thinks they're good at what. All of that gets wrapped up in some of these sort of tensions and trust issues that we uncovered. And of course, every person, every marriage, every couple, every individual investor is different. So it's hard to say exactly what causes it in any specific instance, but what we do know is, you know, what the research bore out, this is clearly a challenge that many women breadwinners are facing, at least, is what we do know.
Yeah. So we've touched on the traditional gender roles. We've touched on the trust. Let's talk about time. What did you learn about that?
Yeah, I think this one is perhaps probably the most unsurprising, particularly because our own prior research has shown that the burden of household responsibilities tend to fall more on women within heterosexual couples, particularly if there are children at home. And then, of course, we know, and there was so much industry research, so many studies on this around the disproportionate impact that the pandemic had in this space. But what we did find in this latest research is that women breadwinners told us that they do tend to take on more of the household responsibilities as well as child care responsibilities compared to men breadwinners. So again, when we think about, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day, we have to sleep for some of them, we have to go to work for some of them if we're working outside the home, we have to do, you know, all the things that we have to do to get through the day and take care of the people around us. And this ties back to prior research, which has shown that many women who are not as engaged in the financial decisions tell us they just simply don't have the time. And I think this is applicable here, you know, specifically with the lens of women breadwinners, as well as the time constraints and that divide and conquer approach.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you clarify, though, again, so this was female breadwinners and male working partners, right? So everybody in these couples is making money. One's not staying home. Is that correct?
No, actually, in some of the households, there might have been a sole breadwinner, and in others, there were two earners. And that's why we clarify at the beginning that we're looking at primary breadwinners. So whether you're the primary because you're the only, or whether you're the primary because you're out earning your spouse in a significant way, that's really who we looked at.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. What I loved about this report, Carrie, is that you put a spotlight on women and same-sex couples. Was the data similar there, or were there differences in some of the challenges that women bread earners in same-sex couples face?
And again, I think going back to what I mentioned earlier, you know, from the beginning, we've always recognized that women are a population, not a segment, and trying to look at different demographics of women to really focus and create an inclusive outlook on this broader topic of women's financial well-being. So in addition to looking at the dynamics within heterosexual couples where the woman is the breadwinner, we also looked at same-sex couples where one woman was the primary earner. And so what we found is that although certainly all women breadwinners face some common challenges, we did find that some of the struggles and challenges apparent in this report were tied more closely to those traditional gender roles within heterosexual couples. So for example, women in same-sex couples said that they preferred being the breadwinner about two-thirds of the time. So that was significantly higher than the less than half of women breadwinners and heterosexual couples who said they preferred that role. Women breadwinners in same-sex couples also had higher levels of confidence around investing and said being the breadwinner made it natural for them to take the lead on financial decisions at higher rates than women breadwinners and heterosexual couples. So those were some of the differences that we found.
Is there a nugget of wisdom in there for UBS? Because at the end of the day, we're doing the research that we can be better advisors to our clients. What did you walk away from? What were the implications of this research?
I think, Jill, you're absolutely right. Like, we can do research in a vacuum and, you know, publish interesting findings and sort of just leave it on the table. But that's not what we're trying to do. We want to actually do the research, glean the interesting data, and then think about, okay, what does this actually mean? What are the implications? What are the implications for our clients and our prospective clients and the communities that we serve? What are the implications for our advisors who are working with clients every day? What are the implications for us as a firm, as an industry? And then really, I would say even at a societal level, and then how can we potentially use these findings to say, all right, what needs to change? What can we collectively think about or do differently or do better? And can we even raise the bar for our industry and more broadly in terms of pointing out and recognizing some of the challenges that women breadwinners face in the hopes of potentially, you know, solving for and correcting them.
At the end of the day, right, if we're looking at this wealth transfer and women owning two-thirds of the nation's wealth in 7 years, what happens if women don't engage and they have the money? They hand it over, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea here is it's important for our clients to feel comfortable engaging. So what were some of the reasons, other reasons why perhaps women were less engaged besides time and, you know, their idea of talent? Is the financial services meeting women where they need to meet them?
I think that's a big question, right? And I certainly think that collectively we can think about how as an industry we can do better. And I think some of that has the historical context as well. You know, it wasn't until it was less than 50 years ago that women couldn't open a credit card in their own name or apply for a mortgage. Not until the Equal Credit Opportunity Act of 1974. So there's a lot of historical and legal context to ensuring that women could gain equal financial footing. And then I think the industry too, we did hear from women that they felt that the industry tends to and has historically catered more to men. And that, you know, some women breadwinners feel that the industry assumes that their partners are the breadwinner. Again, the same that we heard from them when it comes to their social circles, family and friends.
Right.
So certainly I think that points to, as we think about the implications, and I know, Jill, you do this so well every day working, you know, with women and your mission, but just generally, I think for all of us, as we think about how to raise the bar as an industry, certainly setting those assumptions aside, that's a really important thing I think that we can all do. We all bring our own views, opinions, biases, unconscious or conscious to, you know, a conversation. And so thinking about really trying to understand the family's income dynamics when working with a couple and understanding where that money is coming from, who's earning it, not making assumptions, really trying to understand the goals that that couple has both individually and collectively. Certainly, you know, some of the things that you and your team are already doing around reducing the time burden of being involved, right? Because of that major time challenge that we heard. So whether that's automating services, meeting clients where they are in terms of, you know, quarterly or annual meetings, going through the financial planning process to help people feel that they're on track to achieve their goals. I think all of that is very clear from this research. You know, Jill, I'd love to hear from you. When you read this report, what did you think in terms of like, what does this mean to me and to my practice? And also just more generally as an advisor and someone who's passionate about this topic.
Oh boy. I thought it wasn't surprising because I have many clients, business owners, women who have grown these incredible businesses and sold them for $100 million, run complex businesses. And then they turn around after they sell it and they hand the fruits of their labor over to their husbands to manage the money. And it's always surprising to me that they don't feel comfortable doing it. I think one of the unique things about our team, and this is one of the reasons why I joined, is that we do an annual summit with each of our clients each year, and we will not have that meeting if it's a married couple unless both spouses are there. That is a prerequisite because together, two people make better decisions than one for the family, right? A decision made in a vacuum without not checking, but like touching base with your partner, many times you end up having to pivot. And there's sometimes where you're unable to do it, where you're creating trust or you're creating streams of revenue to your family. How much is enough? What's too much? What age? These are decisions which are best made together. So we do a pretty good job at that. And then I believe that women are, and I can't tell you how many really wealthy women that I work with who at the end of the day are still afraid that they're not going to have enough money and they're going to be eating cat food. That's like a quote. You know, being able to build a long-term cash flow plan for a client to show them how their money will play out over the course of their lives, what retirement planning would look like. I mean, those are all great tools. And we can deliver that in a data-filled deck, or we can deliver it in pictures and graphs and charts, right? Like, how does your brain work? Let's come to you with the way that your brain works and trying to deliver the data and the information in a palatable way, meeting them where they are and the way that they learn. So those are some of the tricks of the trade that I've been able to work with. And, you know, again, always making sure that both partners are there for the decision-making processes.
No, absolutely. And I think you touched on a really important part of sort of the broader implications of this research, right? And we say very openly in the report, we can't necessarily solve for the marital discord that might exist around, you know, unequal earning status within a couple. But what we can try to do is ensure that that couple or that individual, whomever we're working with, but again, in the context of this research, ensure that that couple feels confident in understanding, you know, their current financial picture, as well as their future financial picture. And certainly, as you said, seeing, for example, that from a cash flow perspective, you are in a good place to achieve the goals that you have for yourself. You are in a good place to, let's say, retire when you want or to maintain your lifestyle in retirement. That might help then reduce some of the tension that exists around, well, I don't feel like I'm contributing enough and my partner is contributing more than me and I wish I could contribute more, or I'm resentful that they're contributing more. If you realize that actually you are on track to achieve your shared goals, some of that might be alleviated. So I do think that's a huge benefit of the financial planning process that ties directly back to these findings.
I completely agree. And I think another way to engage women, and this goes back to the research from last year in the Own Your Worth report, Women on Purpose, is to talk with your clients or talk with investors about what their values are. What do you value? Who's important to you? What relationships are important to you? Are you religious? Do you care about the arts? Are you philanthropic? Do you care about the environment? How can we pull all of those different values together and integrate them into your financial life? Because every day you're making an impact. Every day you're making a decision. You just went and bought a coffee. It's fair trade coffee. You spent $5. That was a decision. You shop at H&M that probably has an issue with landfills, right? That was a decision. Everybody makes a decision every day, and the items that we buy and how we spend our time that have an impact on the world. And when you can start engaging women in particular on their values, I find that they really light up and they get way more engaged in the investment process. So that's kind of fun for me.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. I mean, that's what the research last year and in last year's Own Your Worth report found, is that the vast majority of women see money. And really money, when I say money, not just how you invest, but how you spend it, how you earn it, as a tool to affect the change that they wish to see in the world and to align with their values, whatever those values may be. And I think that that's another piece too, right? To try to extract more from the conversation. It's not just, okay, you know, this is what you have and this is how you're tracking, but how does that tie back to your goals, your values as an individual, as a family? I think that that approach can be really impactful, because you're exactly right. Every decision you make, where you choose to buy your groceries, how, what car you drive, you know, how you certainly invest, all of those decisions, there's a values component in that. And even not making a decision, not participating in major financial decisions, that is in itself a decision to not actively engage. And there are certainly risks associated with it, which is really what we're trying to mitigate with this entire Own Your Worth message.
That's awesome. I love this. I love this. So let's close this out with a broader question on the Own Your Worth research. I mean, so you've been doing this research now, what, for 6 years? And so you've seen a lot, and it is getting more and more important, in my opinion. But why is this topic so important? And why is it critical that we continue to focus on women's financial participation and bringing more women to the money table?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've really covered it a lot in this discussion, right? We know that money plays a significant role in shaping our lives up until today, but also in terms of shaping our futures, helps us achieve our goals, allay our concerns, helps us retire when we want, pay for unforeseen medical costs or emergencies, buy that dream home, pay for children's tuition or grandchildren's tuition, giving back to, you know, causes and charities and philanthropies that are important to us. So I think that it's really important that everyone, men, women, every investor is engaged and aware of what their financial life looks like now, what it's going to look like in the future, and how they're on track to achieve the things that are most important to them in life. And not just to avoid, you know, those surprises or those curveballs later on down the road, but to also actually have influence over where that road takes you. So that's really, I think, what Own Your Worth is all about and why we continue to do this research and to kind of chip away at some of these challenges that each report uncovers to try to make it easier. And again, to collectively raise the bar, I think, to try to create a financial table that can include more women.
Well, you know, I can say as a relatively new UBS employee that as an outsider, I looked to you as an industry leader. I looked to the research coming out of UBS as an industry leader. And my clients all say the same thing. So it's such a joy to be working at an institution that thinks broadly on this topic, but also goes deep. And Carrie, it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to work with you and your team and keep bringing this great research to our clients, because it's really making a difference in their lives and it makes a difference in my practice. So thanks so much for joining us, Carrie. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Jill, for having me. And again, we couldn't do the work that we do without you and teams like yours. So thank you for being such great partners and helping to shed light on the research and the work that we are doing.
Thank you. And if you'd like a copy of the report, please just reach out to our team.